even if snowplows have been down your street and the streets that you take to work or school, there is still a lot of snow on those streets and a bunch of ice as well. So hopefully between the sun and the traffic, we can beat it into submission here today. A fair amount of what appears to be ice is on those streets as well. And we here at Current State urge all of you to give extra thought to staying safe and warm today, even if you're the type who does all right in the cold, and you know who you are. Today is just different. We are in extreme territory today, so caution is the watchword. Please use some. And welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. 2013 ended on an especially challenging note for tens of thousands of mid-Michigan residents. The Lansing Board of Water and Light has said that nearly 40,000 people in the Lansing area spent from 2 to 10 days without electricity after an intense ice storm brought down utility lines across the region on the weekend of December 21st. Restoration delays and poor communication has triggered widespread calls for an independent review of the BWL's response. A holiday visit to New York City by the utility's general manager, J. Peter Lark, in the midst of the outage, has led to calls for Lark's resignation. Now, this evening at 5:30, the BWL board will address these topics at its first meeting since the outages. One of our first guests is a BWL board member. Dennis Lowney represents the city's first ward. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi, Mark.
And joining us by phone, Lansing City Council member Carol Wood, who is extremely involved in exploring the utility's response to the blackouts and is among those calling for Mr. Lark's resignation. Hi, Carol. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I hope everyone's keeping warm.
Dennis, tell us what the board is going to address tonight.
Well, Mark, we called a special hearing for tonight because of the severity of this crisis. We were hit by a storm that we have not seen before. We had more than 40% of our entire customer base go down, over 100% of the territory. Mm-hmm. And according to the Public Service Commission, no utility in Michigan has ever been hit that severe. So what we've asked is that we want General Manager Lark to come in, and we want the public to come in. And we've asked General Manager Lark some specific questions, what occurred, what was the communication that occurred, where were our failings, and how can we fix those failings and move on? We've charged Mr. Lark with a couple things. We wanted information on the special credits. Consumers and DTE have granted special credits through the Public Service Commission of $25 as a rebate to those consumers who were out more than 5 days. I'm going to be introducing a resolution that will not only meet that, but we will look at adding an additional $5 per day that people are out. Hmm. And some of the beauty of that is being a local utility, being publicly owned, we don't have to stay true to what the Public Service Commission is. We can go beyond that. And so that's one thing, the special credit. Two, a crisis communication plan. We wanted to know after the City Council meeting last week, if this occurred tomorrow, what was our plan going to be? Mm-hmm. So tonight, Peter's going to present that. We've also asked him to look into what are we going to do to fix this, and we want an independent review to do that. Now, that independent review, and we've had some talks with the mayor and with City Council, we think we need to involve public officials, we need to involve citizens, we need a utility expert on there to give some advice. We need to do an internal review, but we also need an external review. And our internal review will be presented to the Public Service Commission for their input. So that's what we're asking for tonight, and we want to hear what else the public has to tell us.
Carol, do you plan to attend the meeting?
Yes, I do.
Do you intend to speak?
Yes, I do.
Okay. What do you intend to be your particular message at this meeting tonight?
Well, I think, you know, Dennis has hit on some of those issues that were brought up at the City Council meeting. I think first and foremost, we have an the board has an emergency plan that dates back to 1998. I don't believe that that's an adequate plan in this day and age, and that needs to be updated, and it needs to be updated on a yearly basis. And there has to be some commitment from the board that that's going to happen, especially as we know technology changes and a number of those things. Second of all is the communication issue. You know, we heard over and over again about different failures that were happening, anywhere from people calling and reporting outages and the next day finding out that they weren't even on the list. You know, those issues have to be addressed, and why they weren't aware of those before, that there were these problems within the system, and make sure that they're corrected. And I think, lastly, you know, whether people want to accept it or not, the fact is Peter Lark is the face of the Board of Water and Light. I believe that he should have been here the entire time. I understand the technology. I understand that you can be on cell phones and textings and emails, because that's how I was communicating with Peter. But when you have exactly what Dennis indicated, a catastrophic event, which is what Peter called it, and that over 40% of your service area is out, the last place you need to be is in New York City while others are suffering. If it meant being down and passing out coffee to the linemen, if it meant going down and answering the phone or being at the customer service desk, that's what should have happened. And so I am going to continue to ask that for Peter's resignation.
Dennis, where do you stand regarding Peter Lark as GM of the Board of Water and Light? Do you support him?
I do support Peter. and Carol said this, and I said this before, this was a catastrophic situation. I talked yesterday with some of our linemen and some of the key people that were out there in crews, and I said, you know, what could have been done differently? One of the things they said was, well, if we would have had 200 line workers, but on a daily basis, that's unrealistic. So I think when you look at it, you have to take that into consideration. So when we look at Peter's performance, as we have over the last 6.5 years as a board, he's done an outstanding job. He's done some great things in regards to the new cogeneration plant. You look at the wonderful First Step vocational ed program we have, some of the community activities we do. Peter's leadership has been invaluable in gaining us awards for reliability and awards for our linemen and their work.
And when you're confronted by somebody whose power was out for days, and they point to an ineffective outage management system, a failed communications plan, and the trip to New York City, and they say, Dennis, how can you support him in light of that? How do you respond to that?
Well, I've talked to people on the phone. I've gotten calls, I've gotten emails, and I've returned every one of those. What I've told them is I understand your frustration, and while I was out of power, I was out 5 days. I wasn't out 10 days, or some of the people actually were out 12 days, but my understanding is most of those had their masks torn off their house. It was inexcusable for Peter to be gone. I agree with Carol in that sense that, as a public servant, as a public official in charge of a utility like this, he needed to be here. And this will certainly be noted when we evaluate him. But I don't think you can take one incident and without looking at the body of his work and say, for that one reason, he should be fired. His being here personally, there wasn't anything different that could have been done. But I agree, the morale aspect, the perception aspect, he was entirely wrong. And we are going to look at this closely and make sure that he understands that that's unacceptable.
Carol, do most of your constituents that you've spoken with agree with you that Mr. Lark should go?
Absolutely. That's what I've heard repeatedly. And I understand what Dennis is saying about the contributions that Peter has made to the Board of Water and Light. But I liken this no different to if you had a police officer that was known repeatedly for the service that he had to the community and was involved in a hit-and-run accident and left the scene. That one incident can affect all the good that they have done. And at this particular point, again, during an event that was, again, characterized by Mr. Lark as catastrophic, leaving was such poor, poor judgment. And then people have been very understanding in the fact they said, you know, it would have been different if he'd been on vacation and this happened and then came back. You know, that they even understood that. But to leave when at the height of this, the majority of the people were still without power, it was unacceptable.
Current state, talking this morning with Dennis Lowney, who is on the Board of Water and Light Board, also Lansing City Council member Carol Wood. A week ago last night at the special council, the city council meeting, Peter Lark said the Board of Water and Light's outage management system was overwhelmed with 40,000 outages. Here's what he said.
That outage management system has got to be brought further along. We've been working on it over the last year. It still needs more work, and I can tell you that after listening to what I've heard today, we will redouble our efforts to make sure that outage management system is working much better and up to its optimum level.
Dennis Lowney, what to your knowledge was the status of the outage management system prior to the ice storm? What work have they been doing on this for the past year?
Well, my understanding was, and Peter said this at the city council meeting, is a lot of software systems that are developed, the bigger utilities will use those immediately to see how effective they are. If they aren't working, then they get new systems in. We monitor that because we don't want to make a large investment without being sure that this is going to be effective software. So we've been monitoring this outage system that we've had in place that consumers initially had, and we were going to be upgrading it. So my understanding is that moving forward, there were plans in this fiscal year to upgrade that system, to start moving towards a smart grid system in some areas of the city, to have some smart meters, and to slowly phase this in. Obviously, we're constrained by rates, we're constrained by our budget, but we felt we could handle it. We had never had a situation where we had 40,000 customers go out and we're getting 30,000 calls all at once.
Well, the other side of that coin is you had a system that you acknowledged was not optimal, and then the general manager still went out of town after that peak number of outages was reported, maybe nearly 35,000.
Well, and I think it's important, too, to understand that the initial readings, I got an email Sunday morning that we had about 150 lines down. As the day went on, by the end of Monday, that was more than 500 lines that came down. So in talking to our line crews, again, I would point to the fact that they said they would fix one line and then have to go back to that same area the next day because the lines kept coming down. No one recognized the severity of this going into it. And we had people who have been with the company 37, 40 years that have gone out and assessed these before. So this isn't something where they were unprepared or untrained. I mean, based on the information we had, we thought we had this under control.
But I want to make clear here, has this been a regular topic of discussion at board meetings? The outage management system?
It has not been a regular topic because we've never been challenged like this before. So it's worked effectively, we knew it was getting outdated. Peter told us that he was going to have a proposal coming into this year to update it. We didn't realize at the time that we were going to be stretched to this severity of a crisis.
Carol, care to respond to anything you've heard here?
Well, and again, we understand that we are talking about a crisis mode, but, you know, part of emergency management is planning for the worst scenario. You know, as been on council for the number of years I have, I know that we go through scenarios of the dam were to break, if there were a plane crash at the airport, all of those things. And I think that this is something that the board should have been looking at as a worst-case scenario through this process. And, you know, hopefully that's one of the things that the commissioners take away from this, that that's something that has to be done immediately.
Well, Dennis, more broadly, is there anyone on the board specifically assigned to oversee the utility's emergency preparedness? How do you, as the oversight board, assess emergency preparedness?
Well, I think, one, we need to bring in some people who have worked in the emergency planning systems. We need to hear from those experts, and we need to find out what our methods are and are they effective. Obviously, they weren't for this situation. So moving forward, assessing any emergency plan, we need to bring an expert in that can provide us useful insight and expertise, but we need to start from scratch and say, where were our failings here? What are we going to do to improve? And I can't commend enough citizens who stepped up. I just want to do a shout out for a couple people, Alice Drager, Jeff Pratt in East Lansing, who helped organize residents out there and helped communicate to us. But there's many facets of it. So this is something that moving forward, we want to plan in place, but we don't want to just put something in place without making sure we bring in the neighborhoods, we bring in citizen committees so that we can mobilize those forces on the ground if something like this happens again. And I can say, the city did a great job with their emergency planning, but again, that was 9 days later, I think. So for us, I mean, we have to look at this and make some hard decisions and make sure.
But specifically, there's nobody on the board or there's no group of board members who is charged with overseeing emergency preparedness right now.
Well, the entire board is responsible for that. But as I understand it, at the Board of Water and Light, it's Peter Lark and it's Susan Devon. Those two are our key people that oversee the emergency planning.
Now, tonight, the board's also expected to ask Mr. Lark and other managers to put together an interim communications plan in the event of another outage soon. What does that interim plan need to address, Dennis?
Well, number one, it needs to show that we're listening and we care to the public. In my mind, it was deplorable, the communication that went out. There was no way for people to get a hold and find out if they were on lists. Just to talk to someone. I went to the warming centers. I talked to people when they were waiting in line to talk to our customer service reps. And just to tell them, I'm sorry, let me get your address down. I'll make sure we can follow up on this. People appreciated that. I think they just were not getting any information out there. So one, we've got to communicate. That means communicating through radio. That means communicating through Facebook, through Twitter. All social medias have to be considered. We need to have a key person who's going to be getting that information out and coordinating that information. So
this is interesting, though, because, I mean, another serious storm, it is possible we could be subjected to, really, in a matter of days. Has there been enough time been taken and energy put into an interim communications plan that we can have faith that it's going to work?
Well, I think I was on social media the last two nights monitoring what our response was to the public and that, and I'm confident that those pieces are in place for the interim plan is being acted upon, because there was communication out there. There was, I heard on the radio, I heard who to contact if there's a downed line, if you lose power. I saw on Facebook postings almost every hour. I saw Twitter, several postings. I saw the word getting out there on Channel 6, on Channel 10. So part of that is communicating through the media and then communicating in that trickle-down effect, again, of your citizenry, of your neighborhood groups, of your city council people, letting them know what can be done. And I think that was made very clear going into this last storm that just occurred, that we made a mistake in the ice storm. It's not going to happen again. Here's how you can get a hold of us. Here's what you need to do. So,
Carol, have you been monitoring that as well?
I've still been receiving the information from their communications person as to, you know, during the snowstorm that we just had, and I've been posting it out there. Have not heard some of the things on the radio. Did see some information on the TV. Can something better be done? Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I do appreciate about Dennis is out there talking to his constituents. And when I say his constituents, every one of the board members represent either a ward or the city at large. And one of the questions I've asked every board member when they're confirmed, when I talk to them, is how are you going to relate to the public? How are you going to get information out there? That's your responsibility. You are representing them. You're not just representing the board and the council members here and the mayor who appointed you. You're representing that area, and it's incumbent upon those board members to take this seriously enough and be doing that as well.
Peter Lark has also said the Board of Water and Light does not have an outage map. Carol, what's your take on having an outage map? Would you say that the Board of Water and Light needs one of those?
Yeah, I do, but I think, you know, there are some things out there that can be instituted immediately. We watched, you know, through social media, someone develop one just through Google. But if you look at some other utilities, we had neighborhood group, Averill Neighborhood, that found one in Ontario that looked like an excellent map. So, you know, I think there are things that can be done that make it easier for both the board and the public to understand what's happening out there, and to make sure that they feel that their issues are being heard and that they're getting information back. You know, again, part of this whole process has been, you know, we can understand we're in an ice storm. We can understand all of these things. But, you know, with no information, how do I know where to process? How do I know what to do? Can I stay here one more night, or do I need to go to a shelter? And we heard, you know, gut-wrenching stories, and Dennis was there during the council meeting, of people that stayed with grandparents that slept 2 hours at a time to wake up to make sure that their grandparents were still alive, because they couldn't move them, and some wouldn't move. You know, I mean, those are the types of things that we were dealing with during this whole process.
Dennis, will an interim communications plan be submitted tonight?
Correct.
Okay.
The board had requested that from Peter after the city council meeting.
Now, Peter Lark also mentioned you've been working with a consultant on a customer management system, which is part of this as well. Who is the consultant there?
I can't tell you who the consultant is, because at the time they had several consultants that they were looking at. And it's important to understand there's two systems. There's an outage management system, and then there's a
customer management system. Yeah.
And the issue came down to those two systems don't communicate well. One provides a ticket, then that ticket gets sent over to the outage management system. So, you know, for instance, we've talked about since the crisis occurred, can we have a system where anybody whose power is out, they can text their address in, or they can email their address in, and then we have that captured into our system. Currently, we don't have that capability, and especially when you get a large volume. But if they send it electronically, that we can capture that, then let's say a block of houses has their power go out. That circuit comes on, but Mark Bayshore's power is still out, even though the circuit's on. And what right now our current system would say, the circuit's on, you should have power. But we don't know that you're down because you have a line that went to your house that's down. So if we know that and we have captured your information, your address is in there, we can send a response back to that consumer and say, your power should be restored. If it isn't, please contact us, because all it shows then in the outage system is that circuit's back up and running. So when customer service then looks, they say, well, you should have power, which sounds very disingenuous to a customer. But that, again, is the communication issues that we're working through here, and we are going to fix this.
Has anyone asked you how it is that we have such an impressive new $185 million power plant that is up and running now, but these kinds of issues haven't been addressed? Is there a disconnect there? There would appear to be a disconnect there.
Well, I would say there is, in the sense that you go through and you prioritize what your infrastructure's issues are. And again, our system had never been challenged at such a point where it was overtaxed like this. And so we recognize now this is our number one priority. And we're going to address that and fix these problems.
Carol Wood, Senator Rick Jones says he's drafting a bill that would put the Board of Water and Light under the oversight of the State Public Service Commission. What do you make of that proposal?
I've not seen the bill, of course. You know, I think there are a number of issues that the Board of Water and Light commissioners need to deal with, but the Board of Water and Light has been a jewel for the city for a number of years, and I'm not ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater at this point. I'm not sure that we need to turn this over to the Public Service Commission. Do I think there needs to be some oversight at this point and trying to understand, again, what happened? And I think that's why an independent investigation is extremely important through this process.
Dennis, I want to back up just a little bit back to the customer management system. How often was the customer management system discussed by the board over the past year, let's say?
I would say there were a couple times. I mean, and you understand we are approached at board meetings, committee of the whole, and our regular board meetings regarding numerous issues, whether it's water or combined sewage overflow, you know, upgrading our electrical facilities and our generation, going into renewable energies and that. And when you get to the customer service, we knew that there had been additional training for our customer service people. We knew that we were looking at a new software system that was going to be presented in this next fiscal year that was going to marry the two systems and upgrade them with our outage system. But it was working effectively, and it wasn't a high priority on our list, and it will be now.
Carol, have you had any second thoughts about calling for Peter Lark's resignation?
I've not heard anything to this point that would change my mind on this.
Dennis, how challenging has this episode been in terms of your tenure on the board?
Well, obviously, a crisis like this, it's challenged all our board members and all our employees, and I think they've risen to the occasion. You know, much like Carol, when you agree to serve on a board or you agree to serve as a city council person, you represent people. So you need to be their voice, but you also need to weigh good judgment and make the best decisions. And it's been challenging. But when you step into that role, you have to be prepared to do that.
Dennis Lowney represents Lansing's First Ward as a board member on the Lansing Board of Water and Light Board. We've also been joined this morning by Lansing City Council member Carol Wood. They will both be attending this evening's Board of Water and Light Board meeting to address all of the topics we've been discussing in the aftermath of the December ice storm that is set for 5:30. Dennis, Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Dennis.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A new conservative group is hoping to open up the conversation about renewable energy. The Michigan Conservative Energy Forum is working to increase the state's investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy programs. Larry Ward is the executive director of the forum, and he's the former political director for the Michigan Republican Party. Larry, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here today.
What are the overall goals of your organization?
Well, the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum is basically a place for conservative individuals, organizations, and businesses to engage in the conversation about energy, Michigan's energy. And we want to be relevant to the discussion on Michigan's energy policy.
People tend not to link the political right to renewable energy. People are more likely to think of drilling for more oil than solar or wind. Do you feel you're in the minority among conservatives that you want to address renewable energy?
No, in fact, our numbers show that we are strong when it comes to renewable energies. We've done a lot of research. The forum itself has looked into the numbers. And by and large, the conservatives support renewable energies. And in fact, in the state of Michigan, very popular. You know, as you mentioned, it's been dominated maybe perhaps by the left, the whole conversation. And what we really want to do is get the conservatives to move forward and show that we do have solutions when it comes to energy, and renewables are a key part of that.
Do you think that conservatives have supported renewable energy more all along, or is this representative of a more recent change in thinking?
I don't know about a more recent. It's building over time. I mean, as you drive around the state of Michigan, you see the wind towers up. You see the technology improving. Not only that, what it goes back to is about jobs and the economy. And if you think about what conservatives stand for, it's about jobs and the economy, the health of people in our state, and our national security. So perhaps the conversation has been dominated on a different front prior to this, more on an environmental thing, mm-hmm. clean energy, cleaning up the pollution in the air, whereas a conservative comes at it from a little bit different approach.
Are there policies or goals that the forum supports? For example, the state's renewable energy standard, 10% renewable by 2015?
Yeah, that's the current law, which is in place. Looks like they're on well track to make that 2008 law that was put into place.
Were you enthusiastic about that? Were you supportive of that call?
Yeah, it was actually a bipartisan effort. Mm-hmm. Very strong support in going into that. I don't know that we're looking for any one specific policy. The Conservative Energy Forum itself isn't advocating a policy one over the other. What we're really in existence to do is have a seat at the table and discuss where they're headed with this.
Now, Governor Snyder has supported expanding the renewable energy portfolio. How does your group tend to feel about that?
Well, as you know, Governor Snyder's done a lot of research over the last year, put together a whole bunch of different groups across the state that have studied what can be done, what we have the capability of. And he's coming out with those reports, and they've been rolling out over time. Now we have the opportunity coming up, but he'll probably address it a little bit further in a state of the state coming up. But this group is there to support their efforts.
Well, your group is called the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum. Are you actually having forums, gatherings?
Yes, we will be. This is a newly formed group. We plan on having a large number of different town hall meetings across the state, working closely with state representatives out there. Educating people on what Michigan energy and how we got to where we are and where we should go in the future.
You see renewable energy as a particular job creator then, providing a real spark for the economy?
Absolutely. And if you think about it, the number of jobs that come from this, you drive across the state and see the wind towers that are going up. We have a strong manufacturing base. Anything related to expanding renewables will create jobs in the state of Michigan.
Where are your members on the issue of global warming and climate change?
You know, we have not addressed that. We're not down. That's not our motivating factors. As I said earlier, it's about jobs in the economy. It's about the health. It's about national security. We think about our energy sources of where we get them from. We spend over $1 billion a day in going out to other countries to buy our energy sources in this country. It makes no sense to do that. Let's bring them back to homegrown clean energy here in Michigan.
Our guest here this morning on Current State is Larry Ward. Larry is the executive director of the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum, and he is the former political director for the Michigan Republican Party. How did discussions with your fellow conservatives go who are not as open to renewable energy? Are you doing a lot of persuading here or arm twisting?
Well, persuading in some sense, it's educating in a lot of senses. You know, we've done the research. What fascinates me is you'll do things and ask people where their energy comes from. And people don't realize when they turn their light switch on and the power comes on, they'll tell you who they pay their bill to, Border Water and Light, Consumers Energy, DTE. But what is the generation source for that power? And 60% or so in this state of Michigan comes from coal. Well, we have no coal in the state of Michigan. We spend $1.2 billion a year to bring in coal to the state to generate our power. We have other sources here in the state. So as I talk to my fellow conservatives out there, each of them has a different take on the types of elements. And one of the things the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum has been keen on is staying with an all-of-the-above approach. And by that, I mean we look at the natural gas and biomass, wind, solar, those things that are renewable. And as Governor Schneider's emphasized lately, expansion of energy efficiencies. You know, just in saving on what we can save means that we don't have to generate and create that next power plant.
Where does your forum stand on hydraulic fracturing or fracking?
Natural gas is abundant in the state of Michigan. I think it's a great alternative. Even your prior guest talking about the Border Water and Light here in their cogeneration plant switching over from coal to natural gas. And so when it comes to that, we're not key pushing for fracturing, but we are a natural gas supporter.
Mm-hmm. How is your organization funded?
You know, we're a volunteer organization, and across the state, we've been trying to gather up support. We are looking for other funding sources currently so that as people come on board, we'll have the opportunity coming up. We have a Facebook page that has been established. Encourage everyone to go there and check out Michigan Conservative Energy Forum. And that's where we're looking for funding.
2014 is going to be an important year in Michigan with regard to energy policy. The legislature is expected to take up the governor's proposals for Michigan's energy future here very shortly. Are you looking forward to getting your group's views into this debate?
Absolutely. And that's what this group is about, is making sure that we have a seat at the table, that we're relevant to the discussion. We share our solutions for what we believe in. And we encourage and give some type of backing and support to any legislative person out there that wishes to step forward and take on renewable energies.
Have you picked up allies in the legislature?
Yeah, strong support so far. You know where the real support comes from, and it's fascinating watching it, is with the youth. The youth across the state, and one of our key leadership council members is the co-chair of the Michigan Federation of College Republicans. Michael Stroud came on board with us. And if you talk to anyone under the age of 30, they understand this issue. They get that we can have renewable energy sources as part of our mixture. And so it's encouraging to see them come on board and help us out.
Is there a particular aspect of this energy debate that we're going to see in 2014 that you're especially interested in participating in or watching?
Not any one particular. We'd love to see it unfold and be part of that discussion. So as the year goes on, yes, it is an election year, and I think it will be key. We'll see how big a key it is coming up. The governor has a State of the State speech. See how much he discusses energy efficiencies and renewable energies going forward.
What do you see as Michigan's biggest energy challenge going forward? Do you think of it in those terms?
I don't know about a challenge in the sense of energy. I think looking at all the different factors and the different diversification of our energy sources, again, going back to that all-of-the-above approach, mm-hmm. Not to pick on any one thing. You know, with Michigan generating so much of its power from coal is not going to go away overnight. You know, that's the reality of it. But as we get different energy sources coming into the mix, how do they play out economically, jobs, health, national security, and those types of issues?
Any particular thoughts on tar sands?
No thoughts at all.
It's one. It's one of the all of the above.
Sure, and you know, if you look at, we will depend on fossil fuels. There's no doubt about that going forward. How big a mixture we can have of renewables and how that helps the economy in Michigan, I think, will be key.
Okay. Larry Ward is the executive director of the Michigan Conservative Energy Forum. Larry, thanks for your time.
Mark, thank you very much.
Good luck. This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Each year, the Library of Michigan chooses 20 books, which feature notable Michigan residents, historical events, and Michigan writers. The 2014 Michigan Notable Books list includes works of poetry, memoirs of cities, and photographs from around the mitten. Randy Riley is the Michigan Notable Books coordinator, and he joins us to break down this year's best Michigan books. Randy, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
What are the requirements for being considered for this list?
Well, I mean, it has to be a book that has something to say about Michigan. And for the 2014 list, the books all have to be published in 2013.
And who's responsible for actually compiling this list?
Yeah, the Library of Michigan does this. We're a section within the Michigan Department of Education, and we have a committee of obviously plenty of librarians, but booksellers, authors, reviewers that get together. There are 13 of us, and we talk about Michigan books, and we try to whittle it down from a given year. It can be from 200 to 350 books, and we whittle the list down to 20.
And what factors do you consider there?
I mean, we're looking at, we want it to, one, it has to say something about Michigan, but the quality of writing is very important when we're making these selections. And I know that in doing that, you know, we've intentionally, it's a list of 20, which makes it easier than trying to find that one best book. And we sort of intentionally stay away from that. This is the best list. These are notable books. It's very subjective when you start looking and evaluating books. But these are books that all are well-written, have something to say about Michigan, show off the state in some way or the talent of people who live in this state in some way. And we think there's something for everyone on this list. That's really important when we're pulling it together, too.
Well, let's take a look at the list. There are several books that focus on Michigan history, including the book Beyond Pontiac's Shadow, Michilimackinac and the Anglo-Indian War of 1763 by Keith Witter. Also, I Invented the Modern Age, The Rise of Henry IV, that's by Richard Snow. What do these historical accounts have to offer readers?
I think, you know, the list has history, it has fiction, it has poetry. These books are just are two solid books that talk about big events within Michigan. Keith Witter's book about Pontiac's Shadow, that whole the importance of what was going on with Michilimackinac and the relation with the Indians and the war that took place there. He does a great job in a big book outlining that whole story and making it very clear and precise for people to understand. The book of the Henry Ford book, there's a lot of Henry Ford books out this year with the 150th anniversary of his death. This one is a very readable discussion of just how he started the Ford Motor Company and the things that he had to do to make it go. So it's something that you don't have to be, it doesn't read like a textbook. It reads very easy for all types of readers.
On a lighter note, I also see The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich by Doug Wilson. A good read?
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you like the Detroit Tigers, and if you were like me, a teenager in the late 70s when Mark Fidrich pitched, this book hits home. You know, he sort of made baseball cool again to see Mark Fidrich on the cover of Rolling Stone, the first athlete to do that, and the whole story of talking to the ball and what a personality he was and what a tragedy it was that he died so young.
Yeah.
The book is really a celebration of his short, brilliant career that he had in Detroit.
Now, the list also features several collections of poetry, including Poetry in Michigan in Poetry, which is a collection of Michigan's most recognized poets. You also included The Way North, Collected Upper Peninsula Works, edited by Ron Rickey. Current state spoke with Ron Rickey earlier this year. He said that the UP's literary traditions and presence is often ignored. Was it important to you to include a book involving the Upper Peninsula?
You know, when we have no formula when we're looking at what books to include, but obviously this is a book that's, or a list that's supposed to represent the people of Michigan. So we're always very conscious to what do we have about the UP? Do we have urban? Are we covering Detroit? So that's something that we think about when we're evaluating. And Ron's book that he edited does have tons of Upper Peninsula writers, some of it in essays, short stories, and a lot of poetry. It does give you a feel for what the folks in the UP have to say and the talent that's up there. The one Michigan in Poetry, or Poetry in Michigan, Michigan in Poetry, that's kind of a greatest hit of Michigan poets, if you will. It has all the kind of the best-known poets that are associated with Michigan have contributed to that book, and it's beautifully done with a lot of artwork that's part of that book as well. It's a nice read and a nice book to have sitting on your coffee table, too.
Current State talking with Randy Riley, who's the coordinator of the Michigan Notable Books List. The 2014 list has just been released. I see the list also features another author that we dealt with here on Current State some months ago, Gordon Young's book, Tear Down, Memoir of a Vanishing City. Remind our listeners what Young's book is all about.
Yeah, he writes about the challenges that the city of Flint has had, and how the city is going through some bad times and its connection to the auto industry. But it is his story. He has a love for that area of Michigan, that place where he grew up. And it talks about just what's happening in the area of Flint. And that's not unusual to a lot of these cities in Michigan that are going through some really tough times. We're really careful, though, you know, this whole thing of what's known as ruins porn that's coming out about Michigan with the decline of Detroit and Flint and some of our urban areas. We don't want to highlight the negative of that, but we think this teardown has something to say about the spirit and the strength of this city as well.
There's a number of titles involving Detroit on the list. For someone who wants to read up on the Motor City, what options do you recommend?
I mean, of course, being part of the list, I think they're all great. But I think the book that Detroit's Race Riots, Racial Conflicts, is a very good read to give people a perspective of what was going on in Detroit in the late 60s. And a book that Charlie LaDuff's book that's Detroit, An American Autopsy, where he's talking about the challenges that Detroit has gone through, is a great read as well. Not everybody loves Charlie LaDuff's perspective on what's happening in Detroit, but this book does have something to say. It's part memoir of his experience of growing up in Detroit and coming back to the city of Detroit after being away for a while.
I take it there are some books on the list that focus on the visual as well, as opposed to the written word. I'm looking at Tuesdays with Todd and Brad Reed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's what the Reeds did, a father-son group from northern West Michigan. They decided for a year, every Tuesday, they were going to go out and take pictures of Michigan, their Michigan, cities, rural, wherever. And in this huge book that they've put together, it's just a stunning visual images of some of the best places and the great things that Michigan has to offer. They've made available through that book.
Again, that's Tuesdays with Todd and Brad Reed, a Michigan tribute. Your program's been running since 2002. Has the quantity or the quality of options to choose from changed much in those 12 years?
You know, I think I'm surprised every year by how many great books are coming out by Michigan people. It's that way year after year. There's a ton of just really great stuff, and if it's poetry or fiction or history, and it seems to ebb and flow too. Some years you'll be amazed by all the great fiction, and other years by all the great children's literature. But there's always great things. And that's a big thing that this program is doing, because the minute this list comes out, I've got email and phone messages from people saying, I can't believe you have this book instead of that book, or you should have selected this one, it's better than the other. But I think that's great.
Yeah.
How often are people arguing about books, and how often are people arguing about Michigan books? And in a nice way, I encourage these people to make their own lists and share them, because that's the importance. There's great stuff out there. People should know about it. People should be reading it. And that's a big part of what this program is all about, to get that discussion going and get people going to their local library, their local bookstore, to explore these great books.
One last rather quick question here. Are books about Michigan and Michigan authors taking on a larger role on the national scene? Do you see progress there?
I think so. I mean, sometimes, you know, if it's East or West Coast, they only think that's where creative talent lives. But I think if you see, a lot of these authors from Michigan are gaining lots of traction nationally for their works and what they have to say. I believe that is the case.
Great conversation. I remember talking with you months and months and months ago scheduling this interview, and it's finally happened. It's been great fun. Randy Riley is the Michigan Notable Books Coordinator. The 2014 list was released last week. Randy, thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thanks for having me. Contact the Library of Michigan if you need more information.
Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we recap the Board of Water and Light board meeting scheduled for 5:30 this evening. Also, we learn more about why Michigan's senators have asked a federal agency to check on the safety of an oil pipeline that runs under the Great Lakes. All that and more tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. Be safe. This is 90.5 WKAR in Current State.